Mrs. Rayburn's Waxwork by Lady Eleanor Smith. The rain, which had poured with a pitiless ferocity for so long upon the chimneys and roofs of the great manufacturing city, seemed at length to enclose the whole town within towering prison walls of burnished steel. It was now afternoon. The short winter day was nearly over, and it had rained thus from dawn, would probably continue to rain throughout the night. A dark, wet dusk began to envelop the city like a sable blanket. The street lamps sprang into life, looming ahead like the ghosts of drowned and weary daffodils, casting watery and trembling reflections upon the shining rivers that were pavements. There were few people walking the mournful streets, and those there were had to struggle and batter their way through sharp gusts of wind, bent double beneath dripping and top-heavy umbrellas. Such a one was Patrick Lamb, and so great was his hurry that more than once, as he stumbled over an unperceived curb, he ran the risk of entangling both himself and his umbrella in the foaming muddy torrents of the gutters beneath his feet. He had every reason to hurry. He was on his way to apply for a job, and he feared that unless he hastened, he would be too late to secure this vacancy which meant so much to him. Turning at last into a dark and narrow street, he saw opposite to him a ramshackle building of yellow brick, from the roof of which swelled forth a glass dome encrusted with the dirt and soot of ages. A flight of shallow steps led to a swing door. This was his destination. He flung open the door and was immediately confronted by a turnstile, near which sat a seedy-looking man in an ill-fitting uniform, not unlike that of a fireman.
"Sixpence, please," said the man, and whistled through his teeth.
Patrick Lamb shook his head.
No, I'm not a visitor. I have an appointment with Mr. Mugovan, the manager."
"Aha," said the attendant knowingly, and showed him into a tiny slice of a room filled with papers, files, account books, and dust. Here sat Mr. Mugovan, a fat, podgy man with thick legs and a face like a tomato.
"Good afternoon," said Patrick Lamb hesitatingly. "I hear that you have a vacancy here for an attendant."
Mr. Mugovan stared for a moment at the young man's sallow, rather long face, at his deep-set grey eyes and slender, puny body.
"Who told you so?"
"My landlady in Berry Street. She knew the last man you had here."
"And what made you come?"
"Necessity. I'm in need of work. I was stranded here a week ago with a theatrical company." There was a silence. Mr. Mugovan suddenly laughed, looking at his visitor rather defiantly, with little red-rimmed eyes that were not unlike the eyes of a pig.
"Oh, rather a come-down, isn't it, for an actor to find himself minding Mugovan's waxworks?"
"That doesn't matter, sir. And if you'll only let me, I'll mind them damn well."
"It's long hours,"
said the proprietor, still speaking contemptuously.
9 in the morning till 7 at night. An hour for lunch and an hour for tea. £2 a week, and the attendant has to wear a uniform. An actor wouldn't fancy that, would he?"
"Maybe I'm not an actor," said Patrick Lamb.
Mr. Mugovan spat upon the floor.
"I'll give you a trial any hour. What's your name?"
Patrick told him,
Well, Lamb.
And the proprietor creaked himself out of his chair, revealing, incidentally, that he wore carpet slippers and had bunions.
Come with me, and I'll show you Mugovan's beauties before you go. You can start tomorrow morning.
Obediently, Patrick followed his new employer through the turnstile, which was swung round obligingly by the other attendant, down a narrow, whitewashed tunnel into a large apartment.
Ever seen figures before?
Inquired Mr. Mugovan. Waxworks? Not since I was a kid.
All of monarchs?
Said Mr. Mugovan, sucking his teeth with a depreciating sound. The room in which they found themselves was bare and vault-like. Here, too, the walls were whitewashed. The floor was covered with a red drugget, and in the middle of the room was placed a sofa, upholstered in shabby crimson plush. Yet, although bare, the room was not empty, but crowded, crowded with a pale throng of mute and stiff and silent figures. They stood in groups, a dais to each group, and were protected from the public by a red cord which imprisoned them like sheep in a pen, so that had they wished, they could not have strayed, but must forever remain captive. There they stood, and would no doubt stand throughout the ages, these tinsel kings and queens, Plantagenets and Stuarts, Tudors and Hanoverians, calm and blank and dreadfully remote, pallid of cheek and glassy of eye, indifferent to all who passed by to gape at them, a host of waxen princes, all dead, many of them forgotten, terribly isolated in their garish splendour, uncannily galvanized into a crude semblance of life that yet denied them even the elements of life, leaving them fixed, frozen, and staring, while the dust thickened upon their cheap and fusty robes of purple and sham ermine. Opposite the door through which they had come was another door, leading to yet another chamber. Mr. Mugovan led the way.
"Curiosities and horrors,"
he explained carelessly. They passed through the second door. Here was another room, a replica of the first, but more dimly lighted, more melancholy even than the Hall of Monarchs, since the illumination that winked upon this dreary scene was greenish, ghastly, such a light as might have been expected to proceed from a sconce of corpse candles. Here were more massed ranks of still impassive figures, paler these than the monarchs, in the dim grotto of their melancholy chamber, and more repellent, perhaps because their stiff, indifferent bodies were clothed in the garments of every day, and borrowed no majesty from princes' robes, however sham. A skeleton gleamed white in one corner of the room. There was a stuffed ox with six legs, a tiny waxen midget, and a giant of local fame. Save for these, the room was peopled only with men who had killed, and who had paid the penalty for killing. A throng staring before them, expressionless, rigid, mask-like, brooding, perhaps, upon their crimes. Mr. Mugovan seemed more at home in the second room. He became almost conversational.
"Here's Hopkins, the Norwich Strangler. Tracy, who shot a policeman. John Joseph Gilmore, cut the throats of his wife and two children."
They moved across the room. Then, near the slit of a window, crossed by iron bars, Patrick saw her for the first time. She stood on a little dais by herself, a young woman, or rather the effigy of a young woman, dressed neatly in dark clothes that were already old-fashioned in cut. She carried herself proudly, like a queen, Whereas the other waxworks were completely expressionless of countenance, this one alone, with proudly curling lips and short, imperious nose, seemed, he thought, actually to live. Perhaps because she was disdain incarnate. She stood there easily, gracefully, long pale hands folded upon her breast. And Patrick, gazing, felt the cool, amused stare of her grey eyes. For a moment his heart leaped sharply, startling him, and he had a sudden impulse to move forward and look more closely at her. Then this sensation was succeeded by a creeping feeling of curious discomfort. He was embarrassed. He had to avert his eyes. "Who's that woman?" he asked impetuously, and then wished that he had not spoken. Mr. Mugovan answered him casually, with his back turned to the effigy.
"That's Mrs. Raven, the poisoner. And that's the lot. So come on."
"Mrs. Raven, I seem to know the name."
"No doubt, no doubt. It was well enough known at one time."
They walked away, toward the Hall of Monarchs, and Patrick was acutely conscious of the supercilious grey eyes that must be gazing after them. The sham eyes of a sham woman, a waxen effigy. He felt acutely ridiculous. Mr. Mugovan said no more until they found themselves once again in the little office. Then, offering Patrick a cigarette, he asked suddenly,
"You're not a fanciful sort of chap by any chance?"
"Fanciful? You mean nervous?" "No. No, I can't say that I am." "Why?"
"No place for fancies, this," confided Mr. Mugovan, waving his hand in the direction of the exhibition. "It's a lonely sort of a job most of the time. And once you start thinking the figures is looking at you, well, you're done, that's all. Last chap we had here took to having fancies. That's why you've got the job."
Patrick felt suddenly rebellious.
"I can safely say I shan't have fancies," he said, laughing. "I may not be particularly brave. In fact, I'm not. But I must say it would take more than a parcel of wax dolls to scare me."
"Oh, figures aren't dolls," Mr. Mugovan corrected, shocked.
"Figures, then."
And he thought, talking of figures, that woman, Mrs. Rayburn's, got a good one. But neither he nor Mr. Mugovan mentioned the name of the woman poisoner aloud.
9 o'clock tomorrow, then," said Mr. Mugovan.
9 o'clock tomorrow."
And so they parted. He discovered the next day two things about his new job. One was that his long and often lonely vigil with the waxworks gave him at times the curious and eerie sensation of being buried alive in a vault filled with the dead. The other, that with the morning, Mrs. Raven, poisoner, had become once more a waxen effigy, and was no longer a living, breathing woman. This was comforting, yet in some strange way disappointing, for it was idle to deny that he had thought of her very frequently during the course of the night, and that the prospect of meeting once more the direct gaze of her rather mocking eyes had undoubtedly stimulated him, and sent him forth into the cheerless streets, kindled with an eager, sparkling excitement, which he rather half-heartedly strove to suppress. As the morning dragged by, he studied a catalogue of the exhibition, trying to memorize the many dossiers of princes and murderers. He was accustomed to learn by heart, and in 3 hours his task was almost complete, yet with one exception. A curious convulsion prevented him from reading, even to himself, the brief account in the catalogue of Mrs. Raeburn's crime, of discovering, through the medium of one cheap, smudged paragraph, that she had been an infamous woman, a monster of vice and cruelty. Taking a penknife from his pocket, he cut away from his catalogue all record of her dark deeds. Yet she remained throughout the morning a lifeless effigy, and after glancing at her once, he gladly looked away. He went out to lunch and returned for the long vigil of the afternoon. Few people came to visit the exhibition. A pair of schoolchildren in charge of a maiden aunt, two girls who giggled and eyed him coyly, and an amorous couple who plainly regarded his presence as a nuisance. It was foggy outside. Dusk fell early. For the first time that day, as he paced the Hall of Monarchs, he became sensible of the loneliness of his position. Once again, the feeling of being buried among the dead returned to him, intensified this time by a bored and brooding melancholy, whereas in the morning there had also been a sense of adventure. The very tread of his feet, the only sound in the still apartment, smote lugubriously upon his ears. He would have liked to smoke, but this was, of course, forbidden. At length he turned, and obeying an impulse which was becoming every second stronger, he moved toward the farther chamber, the hall of curiosities and horrors. Here the twilight struck gloomily upon the wan and glimmering faces of the murderers, upturned to greet the first dark smoky greyness of night. Greenish they were once more, and dismal, and very hopeless in the blank resignation of their weary vigil in this dim room that was filled with the very breath of genteel decay. He went straight toward the figure of Mrs. Raeburn, standing tall and quiet and erect on her dais below the barred window. He had never been so near to her before. Their eyes met, and once more she had recaptured that spark of life which had so curiously impressed him on the previous day. He gazed for some moments at her pale, clear-cut face, at her direct, ironic eyes. She appeared to return his scrutiny, gravely, earnestly, scornfully, yet with a glint of interest and humour in her regard. She seemed, he thought, a woman well used to curious eyes, well able to defend herself against the stares of the inquisitive. Suddenly, to his immense astonishment, he spoke to her, and his voice rang out strangely enough in that silent room. "I wonder what you have done," he asked her abruptly. "For God's sake, what can you have done that you should be here?" There was a long pause, during the course of which he continued to examine her closely. Was it his imagination, or did her lips really curve? Was there an answering twinkle in her eye? And then he turned sharply, for he had caught, or thought that he had caught, a soft, eager, rustling sound from the throng of effigies behind his back. And suddenly he was saved, for two little boys came pattering in to visit the curiosities and horrors. The next day saw him resolutely keeping to the Hall of Monarchs. Here, with the lifeless dummies of long-dead kings, he was safe. In that other room he realized that he was in peril, and the day after, although he hungered for a glimpse of Mrs. Raeburn's pale face, he still remained aloof. The next day was Saturday, with a steady stream of patrons, who would have made the dankest vault seem homely and prosaic. Then Sunday, a holiday, On Monday he returned to the exhibition, ready to laugh at himself for a morbid fool. The rain had stopped, a feeble ray of primrose sunshine filtering through the barred window of the second chamber made even Mrs. Raeburn seem little more than a cunningly fashioned doll of life size. And he had spoken to her as though she were alive and could hear and understand him. He was disgusted with himself. Yet, with the swiftly flowing dusk, the murderers changed once more, assumed as was their wont with the shades of night, the vivid and evil personalities they must have worn during their lifetime, seemed to stretch themselves, as though released from some long spell of immobility, nodded perhaps to one another, even winked, perhaps brushed the dust from their shabby garments, smothered yawns, and waited, quietly expectant, for the closing of the exhibition. So Patrick thought, but it was difficult to see. The shadows were thick in this lost and forgotten room. He went toward the effigy of Mrs. Raeburn, and was not surprised to find that her eyes, alive and brilliant, almost feverish in their eager intensity, remained fixed directly upon him, as though she waited to see whether he would, after his 3 days' absence, speak once more to her. He was, however, silent. He stared at her proud and beautiful mouth, at her long, pale hands, at the white stem of her throat, and admitted to himself that he desired her, yet he had no immediate wish to touch her, but only longed passionately for the stiff, waxen body of this effigy to melt and transform itself into warm, living flesh and blood. Somewhere, somehow, this miracle must be accomplished, for if he was unable to possess her, he thought that, such was the spell she had cast upon him, he must inevitably pine and sicken, for she was la belle dame sans merci, and he was in her thrall. At last he spoke to her, softly, scarcely knowing that he spoke. "You are a witch," he said, "and you possess me, body and soul. You ought to be burnt, and since you are made of wax, it should not be difficult to destroy you. I have a good mind to try." This time there was no mistake. A gleam of sardonic laughter came to her eyes, a strange and elfin smile to her curling lips. She defied him, and as before, the row of murderers behind seemed to move simultaneously with a rustling murmur of excitement. As before, too, he was saved by a footstep from the outer world. He turned sharply. A woman came into the room. Patrick stiffened, became once more the respectful and vigilant attendant. The woman hesitated for a moment, then approached him slowly, for she was bent and squat and elderly, and walked with the help of a stick. He noticed vaguely that she was dressed in dingy black, with a frowsy bonnet askew upon her head, and a film of veil that partly concealed her face. He bent down politely. "Yes, madam. Is there anything I can do?"
"There is," said the old woman.
Her voice was clear and decisive, the voice of one who is accustomed to command.
"I have stupidly neglected to buy a catalogue at the door, and as I am old and not so good a walker as I was, I wonder if you would save my going back by being kind enough to tell me something about the waxworks. These are murderers, are they not?"
Patrick, only too pleased to occupy his mind in this accustomed fashion, began mechanically. "Yes, madam. There on my right is Richard Sayers, the Scottish body snatcher,
who shot 2 men before he was arrested, and protested his innocence to the last. Next to Sayers is Mugovan's conception of Jack the Ripper, the criminal who was never captured. This figure is modelled according to the description of his appearance, given to the police by those persons who protested that they had seen him before or after his appalling crimes. Next to Jack the Ripper, we have... While his voice droned on, he was dreading the moment when they must face Mrs. Raeburn, when he would look once more upon her pale, remote face, and meet once again her steady, contemptuous gaze. He lingered beside the midget, the freakish ox, the local giant. The old woman listened to him attentively, beady eyes darting from beneath her heavy veil. Once or twice she asked him a question, but otherwise was silent, seeming pleasantly absorbed in this monotonous catalogue of grim and fiendish crimes. At last the moment dreaded by Patrick could be postponed no longer. At last they faced the figure of Mrs. Raeburn, standing slim and straight and self-possessed beneath the grated window. Suddenly, Patrick remembered that he knew nothing of this murderess, save that she had killed by poison. Here he was speechless, and could recite no bloodthirsty dossier, nor did he even know her victim, only that she was young and fair, and that she had cast a spell upon him, and these things could not be told to his companion. There was a pause, during the course of which the old woman examined the wax figure attentively, and in silence. At length he mumbled, "This is Mrs. Raeburn, the poisoner." As he spoke, he shot a sharp glance at the effigy, and observed that she was blank and mask-like once more, indifferent both to himself and his companion. His witch had again become a waxwork. The old lady shuffled closer to the figure, peered with a certain attentive inquisitiveness, then turned to him and remarked, critically,
"The likeness is not very good."
He was startled, and Gate, unable quite to grasp the purport of her words, he asked, "You knew her?" She did not answer him, but said, still peering,
"She was taller. She had more dignity, more of an air, and I think she was wilder. But it's long ago, and her face changed all the time."
He asked again, trembling, his hands clammy cold, his voice unconsciously menacing, "You knew her?" For the first time, the old creature turned to look at him, seeming to observe him closely. She chuckled, and at first he thought that one of the waxworks had laughed. So ghostly, so unexpected, was this little bubbling sound in the quietness of the dim hall. She said, still chuckling,
"I am Mrs. Raeburn."
And as he did not answer, she pulled back her veil. She was younger than he had at first supposed. She revealed a fat, gross, heavy-jowled face, sallow, unhealthy, with high Mongolian cheekbones. Her nose was squat and thick, her cheeks carved with 2 deep-cut lines running from her nostrils to the corners of her mouth. Her little sharp grey eyes were almost buried in folds of flesh. Beneath the shoddy bonnet, a strand of hair hung untidily. It was dyed a bright orange tint. This face, which leered forth so boldly at Patrick, was seamed and stamped with the marks of every foul and obscene vice. Brazen, debauched,
so brutal as to be three parts animal. It seemed to hang in the air, this gargoyle face, to gloat triumphantly upon his horror and confusion. Then swiftly the woman whisked back her veil and said crisply, in her clear and resonant voice,
"It didn't do me justice, your image."
Then in a moment she was gone, while behind her the effigy of Mrs. Rayburn, poisoner, remained standing cool and pale and remote upon her dais, all the paler, all the cooler, for being now the centre of a flood of cold and frozen moonlight. Patrick fled after the old woman, not because he wished to see her again, but because of the two of them, the waxen image had become the more repulsive. Yet, when he reached the Hall of Monarchs, she had already disappeared. He waited, sick and shivering, until the clock struck 7, and the show shut down. Then he went in search of Mr. Mugovan, whom he found in his office, reading an evening paper with his feet on the desk.
"Good evening," said Patrick. "I want to tell you something."
Mr. Mugovan put down his paper.
"My word, young fellow, you look cheap. What is it now?"
Patrick, gulping, said, "Do you know who's been here this afternoon?"
"I do not," said Mr. Mugovan. "I'm proprietor of a waxwork show, not a magician. Who has been here?"
"Mrs. Rayburn. The real Mrs. Rayburn. She came to see her waxwork. She's just gone." As Mr. Mugovan gaped, his red face became curiously mottled, white and purple in patches, Patrick noticed dispassionately.
"Mrs. Rayburn?"
"Yes." Mr. Mugovan climbed laboriously from his chair.
"Mrs. Rayburn, eh?" "Somebody's been pulling your leg. You don't know your catalogue either. Mrs. Rayburn, indeed."
And he pulled a document from the untidy desk, licked his thumb, and flipped over a page.
"Mrs. Rayburn,"
he said, speaking very loud and not looking at Patrick,
"was scragged. Hanged, you understand. Hanged by the neck for the murder of her husband more than 20 years ago. That being so, you could hardly have seen her here just now. And that's enough of your funny stuff for one day."
Patrick said nothing. There was really nothing to say. Nor did Mr. Mugovan break the silence, but waddled to and fro about the little room, changing his carpet slippers for boots, struggling into his overcoat, cramming a check cap upon his head. In a moment he had gone. Patrick switched off the office light, then went forth, as was his custom, to extinguish the gas jets in the exhibition, before locking up for the night. His comrade of the turnstile had already gone home. He was alone, entirely alone, with more than 100 waxen effigies. It was now quite dark outside, for the moon had fled behind a screen of clouds, and there was a rushing sound of strong wind, which swept in gusts past the shuttered windows. He paused to light a forbidden cigarette, and then it was that he realized with an odd detachment that what he had seen during the afternoon was not a ghost, but something even more monstrous, a disembodied ghoul, the foul and evil soul of this wretched woman, whose lovely image had bewitched him, the hideous reflection of a hideous mind. Behind her seeming purity and beauty had always been this horror, dormant, waiting to leap forth and devour. The wind rose, moaning, battering at the panes. On such a night, he mused as he tramped toward the monarchs, ghouls would surely stalk abroad, and witches soar through the air, clutching their broomsticks, and screaming aloud their lust for Satan. Vampires, sorcerers, fiends, a nightmare pack of horrors. He stretched on tiptoe to lower the gas above the wan, impassive face of King Richard II. And in the old days, witches were burned alive, like the guys now consumed by flames each 5th of November. And after the burning, he supposed that these evil women could do no more harm, but were destroyed forever, they and their spells. Good job, too. He entered the second chamber. That night, the inhabitants of the city were surprised to perceive a crimson flush sweeping the sky above the rooftops of a distant street. Then came a clanging of bells, the roar of motor engines, and, hot foot in pursuit of the fire brigade, a yelling, excited rabble. Mugovan's waxwork exhibition was on fire. No one wanted to miss the show. Doubly welcome, because it was free. The wind was strong that night, and licked the flames eagerly, strengthening them until the efforts of the men armed with hosepipes became pathetic in their futility. At length, the roof crashed in, and a wall of roaring flame rose as though to leap into the sky. They were triumphant, these pillars of fire, as though they knew that they were purifying, destroying a witch. By morning, Mugovan's waxwork show was a drenched and sooty ruin. Many of the figures were entirely destroyed, the monarchs having been on the whole unluckier than the murderers. Down in the Hall of Curiosities and Horrors, there were a few survivors. Some were quite untouched. Mrs. Rayburn, for instance, appeared to have emerged unscathed from the ordeal, and stood upon her dais, proudly and gracefully. Pale hands folded demurely upon her breast. And yet, on closer inspection, Mrs. Rayburn proved not to be entirely unharmed. Her waxen face had melted, and running, the stuff had twisted upon her features. A strange and devilish sneer. Save for her pride of carriage, she was unrecognizable, distorted. And then the fireman made a further discovery. Lying nearby, where the flames had crackled most fiercely, was a charred and sodden bundle of clothing. They bent to examine it. It was, they found, a human body. The body of a young man. Today's story was Mrs. Rayburn's Waxwork by Lady Eleanor Smith. It was read by Jasper Lestrange. I do hope you enjoyed it. And until next time, sweet dreams.